Welcome to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast, where SearchHealthIT.com editors interview leading experts on IT strategies for healthcare leaders.
Hello, and welcome to our latest podcast presentation. I am Craig Beyer, Assistant Site Editor for SearchHealthIT.com, and I'm speaking with Adam H. Green, a partner in the Washington, D.C. Law Office of Davis Wright Tremaine, LLP, where he primarily works with healthcare providers and technology companies on compliance with HIPAA privacy, security, and breach notification regulations. Additionally, he is a former regulator at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in administrating and enforcing HIPAA rules. Today, we will be talking about what organizations must do after a data breach occurs and also strategies for healthcare entities to use after a breach. Adam, thank you for joining me here today on this podcast.
My pleasure, Craig. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by talking about what healthcare organizations must do once a breach occurs from a regulation standpoint.
So a healthcare organization should look at both state law and HIPAA. It's important to keep both of them in mind, and it may be somewhat different analyses. I would recommend starting with state law because, for example, if you're in California or certain other states, it may be a much stricter time frame, and it also may influence your analysis under HIPAA. So under state law, it's worth looking at what are the obligations, what information is subject to state law. So this may require specific identifiers such as social security numbers. Oftentimes, state law will cover a much smaller category of information than protected health information under HIPAA. It's also worth looking at whether the state law is specific to electronic information, as is the case under some states, and also what is the reporting time frame under state law. Some states may have a very short time frame, California being the worst case scenario of 5 business days. So after examining whether you have breach notification requirements under state law, you can then turn to HIPAA. So the HIPAA analysis under the HIPAA Interim Final Breach Notification Rule is a multi-step analysis. First, you want to look at whether you have protected health information. It's worth keeping in mind protected health information is a very broad category. So it's generally going to involve individually identifiable health information. Health information really is any information that relates to a specific physical or mental condition, the provision of healthcare services, or payment for healthcare services. So the fact that an individual has received some sort of healthcare services from a hospital, for example, even without details as to the nature of those services, is going to arguably qualify as health information. You then have to look at whether it's individually identifiable information. And here, the best place to look is the 18 identifiers that are set forth under Section 164.514 in Title 45 of the Code of Federal Regulations. And so these safe harbors, these identifier categories include things like dates of service. So if you have nothing more than that the individual was admitted to the hospital on a given date, but you don't have name, address, or other information, there's at least an argument that you should consider that this information may be considered individually identifiable. So once you've established whether you actually have protected health information, the next question is whether there's an impermissible use or disclosure under the privacy rule. So don't shortchange the fact that there are a number of provisions in the privacy rule, and it's important to keep in mind whether any of them might apply. Oftentimes, though, if you have a completely accidental disclosure, that's going to be pretty straightforward that it's impermissible under the privacy rule. So the next question under HIPAA is, was the information secured? So there's HHS, Department of Health and Human Services, guidance on what constitutes secured protected health information. And currently, that only consists of certain encrypted information, with the encryption qualifying under relevant NIST standards, National Institute of Standards and Technology, or if the information has been properly disposed, such as properly shredded for hard copy information or properly electronically sanitized for electronic information. With the encryption safe harbor, it's also worth remembering that even if the information is encrypted, the encryption key must be secure. So if you lost that laptop of a particular employee of a hospital, it's worth asking them, for example, did they have the password located in the briefcase or on a sticky note on the back of the battery cover? If the answer is yes, then you can't treat that information as being encrypted. So the next question is the harm threshold. Is there a significant risk of reputational, financial, or other harm? It's important to keep in mind that the burden of proof is on the covered entity, the healthcare provider, to prove that there is no significant risk. It's not merely a guessing game. There really needs to be facts and evidence to support your position. That's at least the government's expectation. So some relevant factors to consider when applying this risk assessment are things like chain of custody of the information and the nature of the information. So an example on chain of custody is if you know exactly where the information ended up. It was misdirected to the wrong healthcare provider, for example. But the recipient is subject to HIPAA, and therefore you have some assurance there that the information remains protected. Or alternatively, if it's misdirected to an individual and you get some assurances, which could include an affidavit, for example, that the information has not been impermissibly used or disclosed. So the individual who incorrectly received the information has not done anything with it and will not do anything with it. You can arguably make a strong case in that situation that there's no significant risk of reputational, financial, or other harm if there's no reason to question the credibility of the recipient. Keep in mind weak links that may expose the information to third parties. So if something was, for example, improperly emailed to the wrong individual, keep in mind whether there's a risk that it might have been intercepted. Did the recipient go ahead and look at the information on a public Wi-Fi network in a manner that could potentially expose the information? So you want to really close all the loops on who potentially might have access to the information. If, as oftentimes will be the case, you don't have complete chain of custody, you don't know where the information ended up, or there's a risk that the information might have ended up with third parties, then the other issue to look at is the nature of the information. So guidance in the breach notification rule does talk about the fact that there might be some information that in itself, regardless of whose hands it ends up in, does not represent a significant reputational, financial, or other risk. An example of this would be the fact that someone receives some healthcare services without identifying the nature of the services at a general acute care hospital. The preamble suggests that there may be a basis for finding that this does not represent a significant risk of harm. In contrast, though, if you have a specialized provider, such as a cancer institution, a cancer center, or a drug or alcohol rehab facility, that's going to change the very nature. And the fact that someone was at one of those facilities without any more information, it may be harder to convince the government that there's no significant risk of reputational harm there. So after establishing whether there's any significant risk of harm, it's also worth mentioning that there's a very limited exception if something qualifies as a limited data set and also does not include zip code information or date of birth. Then there's HHS has said that that would also constitute not having a significant risk of harm. But if you go through that significant harm threshold and find that there is a significant risk of harm, the next step is that there are a number of statutory and regulatory exceptions. These come from the statute. There's three of them. One's for good faith use, where there was a mistake, such as an employee pulling the wrong record during the course of their duties. Another is good faith disclosure, where you send something to the wrong person, but it's someone who otherwise would have access to the information. And the third is if you have a reasonable basis for believing that the recipient of the information could not have retained it. An example being you sent out an EOB to the wrong address, but it comes back as undeliverable, you can have a reasonable basis for finding that the recipient didn't get to see the information. Those ones really are not very significant exceptions, because chances are if you met any of those exceptions, you would have already found under the prior step that there was no significant risk of harm. If, however, the harm threshold was to change in upcoming rulemaking, those exceptions might take on much more importance. So that's the process for looking at whether you have a breach. And then the next process is the actual notifications. So you're going to need to have a notification to any of the individuals who are the subject of the information. And the HIPAA timeframe is without unreasonable delay, but no greater than 60 days. This oftentimes gets translated to merely 60 days, but that's not what the rule says. So, for example, if you have all the information at your disposal within 2 days, then there's no reason to wait for another 58 days. And in fact, the government may look very unkindly on any such delay. So you want to make sure you're doing everything without unreasonable delay, and you want to be able to document any delays during the process. Now, state law may be significantly more stringent, with only 5 business days in California, and potentially more, but still less than the HIPAA standard in other states. So you want to be very cognizant of that. And then HIPAA also provides that there's substitute notice may be required if you cannot contact 10 or more individuals. So the substitute notice may involve certain notifications to the media, such as putting something in a newspaper, or alternatively putting something up on your website. So that's notification to the individuals. There's also notification to the media if under HIPAA over 500 people in a single state or jurisdiction are subject to the breach. So I live in D.C. We'll take that as an example. If you had 400 individuals in D.C., 200 in Virginia, 300 in Virginia, 200 in Maryland, 300 in Virginia, then there's not more than 500 in any given state or jurisdiction, and media notification is not required. In contrast, if there was 501 in D.C., then you'd have to notify D.C. media. Now, the media outlets must be prominent under HIPAA, so it must be a well-recognized media outlet. And in practice, what people oftentimes do is provide a general press release. So another notification that's required is to HHS. This must be done through the OCR website. You can't simply provide a letter to OCR or to Health and Human Services generally. You must use the Office for Civil Rights website itself. So if 500 or more people are involved, and that's nationwide, so in my previous example where you didn't have more than 500 in any given state or jurisdiction, but there were more than 500 in the general D.C. metro area, in that case, you would have to notify HHS immediately after notifying individuals and the media. You really do have to do it afterwards, because the report to HHS is going to ask about any other notifications. So it's not very helpful to do this notification first and not be able to answer those questions. If less than 500 people are involved, then you have to notify at the end of the calendar year. And it's actually, you have 60 days after the end of the calendar year. So this past year, you had until February 29th of 2012 to report any of your 2011 small breaches. Although I've been told by people over at HHS, feel free to do it earlier than that, rather than doing it all as part of the end of the year. You'll find that it's not very helpful on your standpoint as a healthcare provider to necessarily do them at the end of the year all at once, because there's not a streamlined process for doing multiple breach reports. And there's a greater possibility that you might run into web problems with respect to the servers being overloaded. So you also need to look at state law. Many states do have notification requirements to particular state agencies, so you may need to do those notifications too. And the one other thing I would add is prepare for an investigation. So if it's a large breach of over 500 or more individuals, you can pretty much count on an investigation. If it's a small breach, it's less clear whether you'll have an investigation, but start preparing for one, especially for the large breaches, looking at things like what was the root cause of the breach and how can it be corrected, putting in place a corrective action plan accordingly, looking at things like, was training sufficient? Do policies need to be changed? Were individuals who are responsible for the breach, if they violated policies, have they been disciplined? And most importantly, for electronic information, would encryption have been reasonable and appropriate? Because if the answer is yes, then that's going to be one of the first things that HHS is going to look at, is why didn't you have encryption, and have you corrected that?
And once a data breach has been discovered, within an organization, how do they kind of dole out responsibility, either from a CIO all the way down to IT staff? How do these roles differ in solving a data breach?
Well, it'll partially depend on organizations, because different organizations will have very different makeups of privacy officer, security officer, CIO. But the other thing to look at is the nature of the breach. So if it's a large breach, especially if you're starting to talk about tens of thousands of people, you probably need to prepare within the organization for the possibility of a class action lawsuit. If you're in California, that seems to be inevitable at this point. You also need to be prepared for the possibility of government fines. And so right off the bat, the C-suite should be made aware and should be regularly updated on the status of this, because these are matters that can really affect the overall reputation and, frankly, the bottom line of a hospital system, for example. So they need to be involved and at least knowledgeable and supportive of the efforts that are going on to address the breach. So you also have to consider that every document is potential evidence to a class action plaintiff's attorney, or potential evidence to the government. So you want to have legal counsel involved, both internal and potentially external legal counsel involved, to make sure that in your haste to respond to a breach notification, you're not making unnecessary admissions that could come back to haunt you later on. So a CIO should take a look at the overall systems and really look at what was the cause of this breach, how that can be corrected from really a high vantage point. HR should probably be involved in any sanctions. So if individuals are being counseled related to the incident, this is something that could qualify as a sanction, depending on your sanctions policy. And you do want HR involved in that case. You don't want to be in a situation where the government comes and says, what individuals were involved in this? They see that individuals violated policies, but there's absolutely no records of those individuals being disciplined. So even if it's just counseling or retraining, make sure that's appropriately documented as a potential sanction. So the privacy officer should certainly be involved in preparing for an investigation, especially if over 500 people are involved. And if it involves IT, then if your chief information security officer needs to document a corrective action plan. And it's important, especially under the security rule, to document why certain actions are not taken. So if you decide that a certain technology, a technological solution, is too costly, go ahead and document that you considered it not reasonable and appropriate based on the cost, and have some sort of analysis supporting that, because the government may want to see why you determined that certain responses were not appropriate. And you want to have high-level documentation, such as a chief information security officer, ruling out certain solutions. Now, the government may still come back and say, we want to see you implement that, but you're going to be in a much better position if you can document that you considered something versus just saying, I considered it, but not having any documentation to prove that.
And a lot of organizations will often create a breach resolution team, but I'm curious how those come to fruition. You can't just, pick and choose certain people. There has to be some methodology behind that.
Well, you definitely want to put together a team, oftentimes referred to as a breach response team, and you want to do it ahead of time. And you want to pick stakeholders that meet a good middle ground, they have to have the time to be committed to the breach response team, and you may certainly discover that this takes up a lot more of people's time than they initially expected. So if someone's not going to be able to actually devote that time, such as a CEO, you want to be cognizant of that. And maybe the answer is just having the breach response team report to such individuals. But you want to have people who are in a position to affect change and affect change throughout the organization. So certainly you'd want to have the privacy officer on that team. You'd want to have the chief information security officer on that team. It's probably helpful to have legal counsel on that team to be able to help navigate the law and to recognize potential legal issues that may arise. You also, the CIO may be a good candidate for that team. They certainly can help effectuate any changes. They'll have oftentimes budget responsibilities. And beyond that, you should look towards your organization. There might be audit staff that should be involved in the team to be able to either directly involved in the team or at least breaches get reported to them so that they can make sure that any internal audits reflect any issues that arise in breach response. Chief financial officer could potentially be on the team, or more likely the reports go to the chief financial officer because oftentimes they're in the organization, understand risk better than anyone else from a financial standpoint, and maybe want to be involved. And you also want to have lower level staff on the team that are going to really be able to support it, to staff it, to make sure, you know, to do the organizing, rather than falling to someone who just doesn't have the time otherwise to do that. And I would also say it's worth running through some tabletop exercises with this breach response team. It's going to take some practice for them to be able to respond in an emergency very quickly. It's something that it is worth, if you haven't gone through an actual breach, it's worth testing them on. I heard some great advice once, which was every member of a breach response team of this particular organization was expected to have 3 copies of the breach response protocol, including the contact numbers of everyone important. 1 copy for their office, 1 copy for their home, and 1 copy for their car. And in fact, that particular privacy officer did run into situations where she had to pull over and handle breach responses from the side of the road, essentially. So it's important to keep things like that in mind.
And the last question that we have today is, when can an organization officially close the book on a data breach? Or in other words, is there a particular endpoint?
It's a good question. With respect to HHS, until you receive a closure letter, I'd be weary of closing the book because HHS, Office for Civil Rights Investigations, can take a number of years. And so it could be quite a few months. It could even be a year before you hear anything after the initial verification process to indicate that an investigation has been opened. And once an investigation has been opened, there could be many months in between different data requests. So don't jump to closing a case just because you haven't heard anything in a few months. Relevant state actors, that could differ significantly. Some state government agencies may be much quicker than others in this respect. But, you know, there could be years that go by without action. So if you haven't heard anything, if you haven't heard a peep for 2 years, you're probably getting to a point where you can close the book on it. But just be careful about doing so earlier than that.
Well, I'm sure this will provide great insight to our listeners, Adam, and I really appreciate you joining me on this podcast today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast. For more information and resources about healthcare technology and electronic health records, please visit SearchHealthIT.com. Thank you.